Chapter 9. Across his forehead, Redlaw still held him by the sleeve when Millie's voice was heard outside. "I can see very well now," she said. "Thank you, Dolph. Don't cry, dear. Father and mother will be comfortable again tomorrow, and home will be comfortable too. A gentleman with him is there." Redlaw released his hold as he listened. "I have feared from the first moment," he murmured to himself, "to meet her. There is a steady quality of goodness in her that I dread to influence. I may be the murderer of what is tenderest and best within her bosom." She was knocking at the door. "Shall I dismiss it as an idle foreboding, or still avoid her?" he muttered, looking uneasily around. She was knocking at the door again. "Of all the visitors who could come here," he said, in a hoarse, alarmed voice, turning to his companion, "this is the one I should desire most to avoid. Hide me." The student opened a frail door in the wall, communicating where the garret roof began to slope towards the floor, with a small inner room. Redlaw passed in hastily and shut it after him. The student then resumed his place upon the couch and called to her to enter. "Dear Mr. Edmund," said Millie, looking round, "they told me there was a gentleman here. There is no one here but I." "There has been someone?" "Yes, yes, there has been someone." She put her little basket on the table and went up to the back of the couch as if to take the extended hand, but it was not there. A little surprised, in her quiet way, she leaned over to look at his face and gently touched him on the brow. "Are you quite as well tonight? Your head is not so cool as in the afternoon." "Tut," said the student, petulantly, "very little ails me." A little more surprise, but no reproach, was expressed in her face as she withdrew to the other side of the table and took a small packet of needlework from her basket. But she laid it down again, on second thoughts, and going noiselessly about the room, set everything exactly in its place and in the neatest order, even to the cushions on the couch, which she touched with so light a hand that he hardly seemed to know it as he lay looking at the fire. When all this was done, and she had swept the hearth, she sat down, in her modest little bonnet, to her work, and was quietly busy on it directly. "It's the new muslin curtain for the window, Mr. Edmund," said Millie, stitching away as she talked. "It will look very clean and nice, though it costs very little, and will save your eyes too, from the light. My William says the room should not be too light just now, when you are recovering so well, or the glare might make you giddy." He said nothing, but there was something, so fretful and impatient in his change of position, that her quick fingers stopped, and she looked at him anxiously. "The pillows are not comfortable," she said, laying down her work and rising. "I will soon put them right." "They are very well," he answered. "Leave them alone, pray. You make so much of everything." He raised his head to say this, and looked at her so thanklessly, that, after he had thrown himself down again, she stood timidly pausing. However, she resumed her seat and her needle, without having directed even a murmuring look towards him, and was soon as busy as before. "I have been thinking, Mr. Edmund, that you have been often thinking of late, when I have been sitting by, how true the saying is, that adversity is a good teacher. Health will be more precious to you, after this illness, than it has ever been. And years hence, when this time of year comes round, and you remember the days when you lay here sick, alone, that the knowledge of your illness might not afflict those who are dearest to you, your home will be doubly dear and doubly blessed. Now, isn't that a good, true thing?" She was too intent upon her work, and too earnest in what she said, and too composed and quiet altogether, to be on the watch for any look he might direct towards her in reply. So the shaft of his ungrateful glance fell harmless, and did not wound her. "Ah," said Millie, with her pretty head inclining thoughtfully on one side, as she looked down, following her busy fingers with her eyes. even on me, and I am very different from you, Mr. Edmund, for I have no learning, and don't know how to think properly. This view of such things has made a great impression, since you have been lying ill. When I have seen you so touched by the kindness and attention of the poor people downstairs, I have felt that you thought even that experience some repayment for the loss of health, and I have read in your face, as plain as if it was a book, that but for some trouble and sorrow we should never know half the good there is about us. His getting up from the couch interrupted her, or she was going on to say more. We needn't magnify the merit, Mrs. William, he rejoined slightingly. The people downstairs will be paid in good time, I dare say, for any little extra service they may have rendered me, and perhaps they anticipate no less. I am much obliged to you too. Her fingers stopped, and she looked at him. I can't be made to feel the more obliged by your exaggerating the case, he said. I am sensible that you have been interested in me, and I say I am much obliged to you. What more would you have? Her work fell on her lap, as she still looked at him walking to and fro with an intolerant air, and stopping now and then. I say again, I am much obliged to you. Why weaken my sense of what is your due in obligation, by preferring enormous claims upon me? Trouble, sorrow, affliction, adversity. One might suppose I had been dying a score of deaths here. Do you believe, Mr. Edmund, she asked, rising and going nearer to him, that I spoke of the poor people of the house, with any reference to myself? To me? Laying her hand upon her bosom with a simple and innocent smile of astonishment. Oh, I think nothing about it, my good creature, he returned. I have had an indisposition, which your solicitude observe. I say solicitude makes a great deal more of than it merits, and it's over, and we can't perpetuate it. He coldly took a book and sat down at the table. She watched him for a little while, until her smile was quite gone, and then, returning to where her basket was, said gently, Mr. Edmund, would you rather be alone? There is no reason why I should detain you here, he replied. Except, said Milly, hesitating, and showing her work. Oh, the curtain, he answered, with a supercilious laugh. That's not worth staying for. She made up the little packet again, and put it in her basket. Then, standing before him with such an air of patient entreaty that he could not choose but look at her, she said, If you should want me, I will come back willingly. When you did want me, I was quite happy to come. There was no merit in it. I think you must be afraid that, now you are getting well, I may be troublesome to you, but I should not have been, indeed. I should have come no longer than your weakness and confinement lasted. You owe me nothing, but it is right that you should deal as justly by me, as if I was a lady, even the very lady that you love. And if you suspect me of meanly making much of the little I have tried to do to comfort your sick room, you do yourself more wrong than ever you can do me. That is why I am sorry. That is why I am very sorry. If she had been as passionate as she was quiet, as indignant as she was calm, as angry in her look as she was gentle, as loud of tone as she was low and clear, she might have left no sense of her departure in the room, compared with that which fell upon the lonely student when she went away. He was gazing drearily upon the place where she had been, when Redlaw came out of his concealment, and came to the door. When sickness lays its hand on you again, he said, looking fiercely back at him, may it be soon. Die here. Rot here. What have you done? Returned the other, catching at his cloak. What change have you wrought in me? What curse have you brought upon me? Give me back myself. Give me back myself, exclaimed Redlaw like a madman. I am infected. I am infectious. I am charged with poison for my own mind, and the minds of all mankind. Where I felt interest, compassion, sympathy, I am turning into stone. Selfishness and ingratitude spring up in my blighting footsteps. I am only so much less base than the wretches whom I make so, that in the moment of their transformation I can hate them. As he spoke, the young man, still holding to his cloak, he cast him off, and struck him. Then, wildly hurried out into the night air, where the wind was blowing, the snow falling, the cloud drift sweeping on, the moon dimly shining, and where, blowing in the wind, falling with the snow, drifting with the clouds, shining in the moonlight, and heavily looming in the darkness, were the phantom's words, "The gift that I have given, you shall give again, go where you will." Whither he went, he neither knew nor cared, so that he avoided company. The change he felt within him made the busy streets a desert, and himself a desert, and the multitude around him, in their manifold endurances and ways of life, a mighty waste of sand, which the winds tossed into unintelligible heaps, and made a ruinous confusion of. Those traces in his breast which the phantom had told him would die out soon, were not, as yet, so far upon their way to death, but that he understood enough of what he was, and what he made of others, to desire to be alone. This put it in his mind, he suddenly bethought himself, as he was going along, of the boy who had rushed into his room. And then he recollected, that of those with whom he had communicated since the phantom's disappearance, that boy alone had shown no sign of being changed. Monstrous and odious as the wild thing was to him, he determined to seek it out, and prove if this were really so, and also to seek it with another intention, which came into his thoughts at the same time. So, resolving with some difficulty where he was, he directed his steps back to the old college, and to that part of it, where the general porch was, and where, alone, the pavement was worn by the tread of the students' feet. The keeper's house stood just within the iron gates, forming a part of the chief quadrangle. There was a little cloister outside, and from that sheltered place he knew he could look in at the window of their ordinary room, and see who was within. The iron gates were shut, but his hand was familiar with the fastening, and drawing it back, by thrusting in his wrist between the bars, he passed through softly, shut it again, and crept up to the window, crumbling the thin crust of snow with his feet. The fire, to which he had directed the boy last night, shining brightly through the glass, made an illuminated place upon the ground. Instinctively avoiding this, and going round it, he looked in at the window. At first, he thought that there was no one there, and that the blaze was reddening only the old beams in the ceiling and the dark walls. But peering in more narrowly, he saw the object of his search coiled asleep before it on the floor. He passed quickly to the door, opened it, and went in. The creature lay in such a fiery heat that, as the chemist stooped to rouse him, it scorched his head. So soon as he was touched, the boy, not half awake, clutching his rags together with the instinct of flight upon him, half rolled and half ran into a distant corner of the room, where, heaped upon the ground, he struck his foot out to defend himself. "Get up," said the chemist. "You have not forgotten me? You let me alone," returned the boy. "This is the woman's house, not yours." The chemist's steady eye controlled him somewhat, or inspired him with enough submission, to be raised upon his feet, and looked at. "Who washed them, and put those bandages, where they were bruised and cracked?" asked the chemist, pointing to their altered state. "The woman did." "And is it she who has made you cleaner in the face too?" "Yes, the woman." Redlaw asked these questions, to attract his eyes towards himself, and with the same intent now held him by the chin, and threw his wild hair back, though he loathed to touch him. The boy watched his eyes keenly, as if he thought it needful to his own defense, not knowing what he might do next, and Redlaw could see well that no change came over him. "Where are they?" he inquired. "The woman's out." "I know she is. Where is the old man with the white hair, and his son?" "The woman's husband, do you mean?" inquired the boy. "Eh? Where are those two?" "Out. Something's the matter, somewhere. They were fetched out in a hurry, and told me to stop here." "Come with me," said the chemist, "and I'll give you money." "Come where? And how much will you give?" "I'll give you more shillings than you ever saw, and bring you back." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.